Welcome to the Happy, Healthy, Strong podcast. Our goal is to equip you with the knowledge and tools you need to make lasting changes in your health. Society has trained us to think that Western medicine is the answer to long-term health, but this approach only treats symptoms and never addresses the root cause. Without a new approach, our community will experience unnecessary sickness and suffering. We teach the functional health model to educate and empower listeners on their journey to a happier, healthier, and stronger life. My name is Paige, and I'm a certified holistic health coach. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Alex Arguello, Doctor of Chiropractic and Functional Health Practitioner. Join us as we unpack some of the most pressing health challenges facing our community today. Welcome back to the Happy, Healthy, Strong podcast. We are going to be continuing our series in the You've Been Lied To, and today we're going to be talking about antidepressants. But before we hop into that information, we thought it would be fun to share with you guys. We typically do this podcast recording Saturday mornings, and prior to recording the podcast, we work out at the gym that is co-owned by Dr. Alex, New City Fitness. And so we wanted to start sharing some of the workouts that we were doing to hopefully inspire you guys maybe to get moving just for fun.
Or if you want to come join us.
Right, exactly. It was only three people this morning, So including us. So today we did, I don't know, you can get into the technical things, okay, but we did like handstand, either handstand push-ups, or in my case, I did hand release push-ups, mm-hmm. which is, you know, just going down to the floor and lifting up your hands. And then we did the ski machine.
Ski erg, yep.
Yep. And then we did barbell front walking lunges.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so a couple things about that. Typically on Saturdays at the gym, we're doing partner or team workouts. So we try to make it a little bit more fun. You're working together with people, you know, it's just a way of still getting a workout in, but building community as well. And typically we're trying to match people up with wherever their fitness level is at. But this workout was a team of three. There was only three of us, and you were with us. And unfortunately you were with myself and Jerry, so the two owners of the gym, the two that probably love fitness more than anybody else in the gym. So yeah, you can be praying for Paige for the rest of the day.
Right.
She did a lot of lunges.
Recovery.
She did a lot of lunges today. Right. But like you said, so for a good workout to happen, at least in the CrossFit world or functional fitness world, there's different categories of movements that you'd want to be doing. So we did something called a monostructural movement. That was the ski erg. So another form of monostructural would be jump rope or running or the rowing machine, those type of things. It's just where you're on the same thing and you're just doing the same movement constantly. Another category would be gymnastics. So we did the push-ups. Mm-hmm. So you were doing hand release push-ups where you were bringing your chest down to the ground, releasing your hands off the ground, and then pushing up. And then Jarek and I were doing handstand push-ups. So that's where we're up against the wall. We're bringing our head down to the ground, and then we're pushing up. So a chest movement, dominant movement, but mainly a shoulder dominant movement. So that's what would be called upper body pushing. So like a pull-up would also be gymnastics, but that would be upper body pulling. So we did upper body, we did a monostructural with the ski, we did an upper body push with the handstand push-ups, and then we did lunges with a barbell, so that would be a weightlifting, which is the third category kind of in CrossFit or functional fitness. So we did all three of those, which that makes a well-balanced workout. So.
Yeah, and we all traded off one person at a time until we got to 500 total reps.
Yeah. So it took us about 20 or so minutes, just over 20 minutes.
Yeah. Teamwork.
Teamwork.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So with that, as we go into talking about antidepressants, we always want to remind you guys that this is not medical advice, and we want you to listen to your doctors first and foremost, but we just want to share some of the research that Dr. Alex has done and some of the thoughts of a functional medicine practitioner.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is a huge one. So last week we talked about cholesterol-lowering medications, which are really for the past 20 years or so have been the most sold medications by pharmaceutical companies, cholesterol medications. But a close second would be antidepressants. Actually, I think it was the third. So the latest statistics that I found by the CDC were way back in 2005 to 2008. That's just how long research actually takes, but that's what they still have on their website anyway, if you looked at it today. And at the time, antidepressants were the third leading pharmaceutical sold. So that's a lot of people that are taking antidepressant medications.
And I can only imagine it's gone up in the last 5 years or so, you know, COVID and all.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So the exact statistic is just over 11% of the U.S. population back then, ages 12 and older, were taking antidepressants. So that's just kind of sad already, you know, somebody at 12 years old already taking an antidepressant. Some more recent statistics, maybe up to 14% of the population, but again, it's still some of the most sold medications that are on the market. So let's just get down to basics. Why are antidepressants given? They are part of just a treatment protocol for various forms of depression, which here's a list. This was from the Cleveland Clinic, I believe, and they are referencing the American Psychiatric Association Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. So that's called the DSM, and then they started with one, and then they've updated it, and now we're on DSM-5, and I'll get into a little bit more about that. But here's all the different forms of depression. So there's clinical depression, or otherwise known as major depressive disorder. That's probably the most common. There's persistent depressive disorder, PDD. There's disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. There is premenstrual dysphoric disorder, that's PM, we know as PMS or PMDD. There's depressive disorder due to another medical condition, like something like thyroid issue, heart disease, Parkinson's, something like that. Then there's specific forms of major depressive disorders. So this would be seasonal affective disorder. I'm sure people are familiar with that. There's prenatal depression or postpartum depression. There's atypical depression, which doesn't meet any of the other forms. And then there's people that have bipolar disorder or manic depressive disorder, something like that. So those are all of the different forms of depression that somebody could go to their doctor, they could get that diagnosis, and then part of the treatment protocol is going to be, of course, medications, most importantly, antidepressant medications. So some other things along with that treatment protocol, there's psychotherapy. So this would be like cognitive behavioral therapy. You would go to a psychologist or even a psychiatrist, some type of a therapist, sit down, talk with them. There's brain stimulation therapy, where they're actually physically doing something to the brain to try to make changes there. And maybe some sort of, again, this is from Cleveland Clinic, who is not completely, you know, just conventional medical. They do look into some, well, again, what we've talked about as being complementary medicine. So they recommend also some alternative or complementary medicine procedures. So that would be kind of the box of tools that medicine would have. Medication, psychotherapy, brain stimulation, or some form of complementary medicine. Now, I've been working with patients for about 15 years now, and when I see some form of depression or anxiety, something like that, on their chart, their intake forms when they come in, it's pretty rare that medication is not used with one of those people. Some of them may also be doing some form of therapy, which is great. But most of them are on medication. So when I see that statistic of 11% of the population ages 12 and older are on antidepressants, that's not what I've seen clinically. I would say the percentage is much higher than that, at least the people that I see. Now, the people that I see, of course, you know, there's some bias there because these are people who already have some form of a health issue that are coming to see me. So it probably is a lot more or higher percentage of those type of people.
Sure.
But here's something that I mean, again, this is just anecdotal evidence. I didn't do a, you know, specific research study on this, but from my recollection, I would say it's more common for people who have some sort of depressive disorder to be on two antidepressant medications, more so than somebody coming to me and have said, "Hey, I'm doing brain stimulative therapy," or my doctor's recommended some sort of complementary medicine procedure. Those are pretty rare. So when I put that together in that toolbox of what medicine uses, those are really far down the list of what you're going to be using. Typically, it's, let's try this medication. If that medication isn't helping with your symptoms, then we'll increase that medication, or we'll add some other type of medication to see if the combination of those two medications will work. So that's kind of a, you know, what depression, all the types of different depression that medications are used for, and, you know, that's the kind of the toolbox that's used in medicine.
Are we lumping anxiety in with this, or is that a
this
separate?
Is so that's the other thing, and I didn't really put this into what we're going to be talking about today, but it is an important topic. A lot of the medication that's prescribed, antidepressant medication that's described, is kind of what we call off-label. So it's not for specific one of those types of depression that's in the DSM-5. it's something like an anxiety disorder. It's something just outside of that list that they would say, hey, let's try antidepressant medication for this because we've seen some results with that. So yes, you would throw that in terms of that number, the how many people are taking it, mm-hmm. but that's not a type of, that would be a type of depression.
Okay.
That's supposed to be used for anyway. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how these conditions are actually diagnosed. I'm just going to read a description from the Cleveland Clinic here. Okay, healthcare providers diagnose depression based on a, so I want you to see if you see a theme here. Healthcare professionals diagnose depression based on a thorough understanding of your symptoms, medical history, and mental health history. They may diagnose you with a specific type of depression, such as seasonal affective disorder or postpartum depression, based on the context of your symptoms. To receive a diagnosis of depression, you must have 5 depression symptoms every day, nearly all day, for at least 2 weeks. Your provider may order medical tests, such as blood tests, to see if there's any underlying medical conditions that are causing your depression symptoms. So I kind of...
Symptoms.
I gave it away there.
You did.
So what I'm trying to highlight there is when you look at depression specifically, there's not a blood test to diagnose depression. There's not an x-ray, right? There's no diagnostic imaging. There's really no objective way of saying, yes, this is depression. It's strictly based off of observation. And then a reference book that we've already talked about, the DSM-5, they look at this and they see the list of symptoms that say, okay, these set of symptoms equal major depressive disorder, these set of symptoms equal premenstrual depression disorder, whatever, you know, on that list. So again, it's not very objective. It's very much subjective.
Yeah.
And honestly, and this is just my opinion, again, this is not medical advice. It has very little to do with any sort of objective science. Rather, it was started and has continued because psychiatric medicine is really the least scientific of all medical areas, specialties, you would say. So it was a way of them being able to work with insurance companies. So insurance companies could say, yes, okay, now you have a diagnosis that we'll actually approve of and then pay for whatever sort of care that you give. Right, so that's back to the whole thing that we've talked about with this, you know, big mix of big pharma and big medicine, AMA, all that stuff kind of working together to make things the way that they are now.
Yeah.
So that's really what happens is you have some sort of symptoms, you go to your doctor, they say, hey, this sounds like some sort of depression. They might refer you to a psychiatrist. They do an evaluation of you, and then they try to match you up with one of these categories in the DSM-5, and then they go to that toolbox, right? Then they go to medications or psychotherapy or the brain stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the diagnosis, and we're already hopefully getting to some things that are eye-opening. But let's go through some of the history here before we get to the specific lies that I want to bring to light, because antidepressants are actually, you know, fairly recent. Again, we sometimes assume that this stuff has just been going on for a long time, but I'm just going to read, this is from a website called Green Book TMS. This is he is the chief medical officer at this Green Book place. So his name is Dr. Jeffrey Grammer. He says the history of antidepressants began by chance in the 1950s. Chemists developing a new treatment for tuberculosis tested the drug iproniazide on patients at Seaview Hospital on Staten Island. It was a crucial step in the history of depression treatment as these patients experienced a dramatic change in well-being. Formerly lethargic and sad, they now reported better mood, increased appetite, and improved sleep. Life magazine even sent a photographer to document this remarkable story. Iproniazide blocks an enzyme called MAO, which in turn breaks down chemical messengers such as serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. So those are called neurotransmitters. Blocking MAO seems to restore these chemical messengers, and this drug helped to confirm that the importance of the MAO system in depression, heralding a new class of depression medications called MAO inhibitors. You've maybe heard that on drug commercials when they read all of the medication or all the side effects really, really fast. At the end of it, they'll say, do not take if you're taking an MAO inhibitor. However, their widespread use was limited by side effects such as elevated blood pressure and liver damage. In the 1950s, the tricyclic antidepressants emerged, while these are super hard to pronounce, so sorry. Imipramine was first tested in people with schizophrenia and proved ineffective. It showed better results in people with depression, was approved as a depression drug in 1959. So 1950s, by accident, they found these MAO inhibitors help people with depression. 1959, they added another type of medication, these tricyclic antidepressants, because it seemed to not work with things like schizophrenia, but it started to work for people with depression. Then in the early 1970s, evidence for the role of serotonin in depression was gathering just as concerns were growing about the side effects of the MAO inhibitors and tricyclic antidepressants were happening. So in that 20-year period or so, these things were somewhat working to reduce the symptoms, but they had a lot of side effects. So they're like, okay, we can't really continue using these. We've got to find something else. And that's where what are called SSRI antidepressant medications started to come in. So that's selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. That's the SSRI. Excuse me. So what the thought is there is that serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter, just think of it as a chemical, a hormone in the body, that you can think of it as a feel-good hormone. So if you have low levels of serotonin, the thought was this was why you wouldn't be happy. This is why you would be sad. This is why you wouldn't be enjoying life. So we got to figure out a way to increase the serotonin levels. Well, again, instead of actually looking at what's causing your serotonin levels to be low, they said, how can we come up with some sort of medication to increase the serotonin levels? And they couldn't do that. But what they found with these SSRI drugs is they would block the serotonin from being degraded. So it would inhibit the reuptake of serotonin, kind of the storage of serotonin. So it would stay in what's called a synapse, or the connections between your brain cells. So you would never really lose serotonin. You wouldn't have the effects of low serotonin in your brain.
Okay.
Because that's what these medications would do. So scientists thus turned their attention to SSRIs. These drugs enhance serotonin activity and seem to carry fewer side effects than other antidepressants. The famous development in the history of antidepressants, fluoxetine, which was approved by the FDA in 1987, reached the market in the following year as Prozac. A year later, almost 2.5 million prescriptions had been dispensed of Prozac once they found this medication to do what
one year
it was doing. In 1 year.
Ooh.
Other SSRIs since were released, including paroxetine, sertraline, citalopram. let me just find the normal names of these things. So this is Celexa, Lexapro, Luvox, Paxil, Zoloft, and Vibrid. Those are the different types of antidepressant medications.
Yep. Sounds familiar.
So in the 1980s, 1990s, new antidepressants that targeted the monoamine neurotransmitter system included some of those ones that I just mentioned. But despite these advances, any history of depression treatment must admit to several drawbacks related to these medications. All antidepressants can carry side effects, including nausea, dizziness, insomnia, and sexual dysfunction. They usually take several weeks to take effect. Up to a third of the people with depression don't respond to these drugs. These shortcomings meant a new era of depression treatment is needed. So that's kind of the history of what's going on, which brings me really to the kind of the main what we would call lie, you know, why it's in this series. So with antidepressants, again, that whole list of the ones that which are different types, but they're all kind of in the same category of antidepressant medication. People are told that their symptoms are due to some sort of, you probably heard this phrase, chemical imbalance.
Yeah, totally.
So there's a chemical imbalance in the brain, primarily serotonin is the one that they're thinking of. Therefore, since these medications can correct that chemical imbalance, if they get that corrected, then their symptoms should be alleviated, right? Now that's I want to just give some praise here, because that's a little bit like what we would want to say is true, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have some sort of cause to a problem. So let's address the cause instead of just trying to cover things up, right?
Yeah.
So they're saying that the reason somebody has depression is because there's some sort of chemical imbalance. So let's try to balance it out so the person doesn't have depression anymore,
mm-hmm.
right? That's good logic, right? That would be good medicine.
Right.
But it's not that simple, right? That's not exactly how these things work. With some people, that's exactly what happened. Especially if they have those low serotonin levels, if that's the only problem. They would take these SSRI drugs, they would see some big changes. And I've had many people over the past 13 years of practicing tell me that they were miserable. Once they got on an antidepressant medication, things radically changed for the better, right?
Yeah.
And then those same people, not all of them, but a lot of those people say, I've tried to get off many times, and when I come off, I go right back into being miserable again.
Mm.
So absolutely, these things are for me. These things,
yeah.
These things work. Now we'll get into a little bit of why their symptoms come back in a second. But what I would want to say is, for those people, these things absolutely are a benefit. They relieve suffering. Thank God for these things. Mm-hmm. Right? I wouldn't want to say that they should have never taken them. But we got to definitely let people know exactly all the things that are going on here, right? Because there's always a risk versus reward, right? You might get a benefit of your low energy, your low mood, your sadness, your lack of happiness and joy might be changed, but what is the cost, right, of that sort of thing? Back to the whole diagnosis thing, there's no objective test to say, yes, you for sure have this depression. Therefore, there's no objective test saying, you have depression, so I'm going to give you a medication, and long term, that is what you should do. Because long term, that's going to keep your depression that maybe, because there's no objective tests, I don't even know if you have. So let's just take the risk of taking a medication for the rest of your life. Again, that's back to, I would say, not necessarily good medicine.
Right.
Because it's just a guess. Now, medicine would say that it's an educated guess, but it's still just a guess. So that's the kind of the first thing that we want to be aware of. But right there should show us that just the whole antidepressant diagnostic procedures, medications, that whole toolbox thing is not as scientific as I think most people would want to believe.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
And we talked about cholesterol medication last week, but at least with cholesterol medication, they can say objective test on the blood sample that we took, your cholesterol is high.
Right.
So we can do something and then we can see that cholesterol come down. Right. And not that you want to treat a blood panel, right? You want to treat the person, but that's still something objective that we can see. Here's where you're at. Let's do something. And now we can see where you've been at. Mm-hmm. With this, it's still subjective. We can say, here's where you're at symptomatically. Let's do something. And then let's just check in with you to see where you're at symptomatically. Now, if those symptoms are drastic and then you see a drastic change, of course, you know, you could consider that even better than objective because mm-hmm. We've now treated the person. The person's better than they were before, but we're still kind of not as scientific as we would want to be. And then we've been led to believe that when you get into more long research, things get, or what we haven't been told is when we get into long-term research, it gets worse. So I'm just going to read some from another article. This was from a website called Mad in America. And our listeners, maybe we can put that in the notes and
yep.
stuff
mm-hmm.
So they can check it out further. This is an article just called Antidepressant/Depression. This is a natural course of depression. Prior to the widespread use of antidepressants, the National Institute of Mental Health told the public that people regularly recovered from a depressive episode and often never experienced a second episode. As the NIMH, Jonathan Cole, wrote in 1964, depression is, on the whole, one of the psychiatric conditions with the best prognosis for eventual recovery, with or without treatment. That's what the head of the National Institute of Mental Health told us in 1964. Given this understanding of the natural course of depression, the NIMH experts believe that antidepressants might shorten the time to recovery. So even though you're going to get rid of your depression without medication, what they're saying is, but we can speed it up with medication, right? So potential benefit. But they wouldn't be able to boost long-term recovery rates. What they found. The reason explained by Dean Schirler, head of the depression section in the NIMH in 1974, was that most depressive episodes will run their course and terminate with virtual complete recovery without specific intervention. So again, we knew back in the 60s and 70s that yes, depression is terrible, makes you miserable, but most of the time it runs its course. Right? You, without treatment, it will actually go away. Now, I would want to say, let's not just let it run its course. Let's figure out why somebody has depression, right? If it's an emotional stressor, let's figure out what those emotional stressors are and deal with them. If it's a physical stressor, let's figure out how we can heal and recover from the physical stress. If it's a chemical stressor, like a toxin, let's figure out how to get that out of their body or get them away from being exposed to it. But even without any of that, they're saying it goes away on its own. Second thing is the chronicity problem appears. Once psychiatrists began treating their depressed patients with antidepressants, at least a few observed that these patients, once they got better and stopped taking the drugs, regularly became depressed again. While the drugs might help people over the short term, they were putting them onto a more chronic long-term path. After reviewing the literature and conducting his own study, a Dutch investigator, J.D. Van Schuwen, and concluded that more systematic long-term antidepressant medication exerts a paradoxical effect on the recurrent nature of the vital depression. In other words, this therapeutic approach was associated with an increased in reoccurrence rate and a decrease in cycle duration. As he noted, other psychiatrists observed that antidepressants were causing a chronification of the disease. So they're saying that yes, short term, you might have, your symptoms might go away, but it's actually creating a long term problem now. So where if you weren't treated with it, more than likely it would have went away at some point, and it wouldn't have came back unless some sort of
trigger,
episode, unless some sort of trigger happened where you were now another bout of depression. But what they're saying with antidepressant medications, that was the trigger. Taking these caused the body to adapt in a certain way that now there was a chronicity of it. Now it turned from a short-term potential acute problem to more of a long-term problem. Next thing is high relapse rate after exposure to antidepressants. So this is an evaluation of continuation therapy with the tricyclic antidepressants medications. British researchers found that 50% of drug withdrawn patients relapsed within 6 months. So half of the people that were given drugs and they tried to get off of them ended up relapsing with medication compared to the people who didn't take the medication. Another one, investigations at the University of Pennsylvania reported that 69% of patients withdrawn from an antidepressant relapsed within 6 months. There was a rapid clinical deterioration in most of these patients. Another one, Robert Preen in the NIMH reported that 71% of depressed patients relapsed within 18 months of drug withdrawal. And last one, in a meta-analysis of the relapse literature, Harvard researchers concluded that at least 50% of drug withdrawn patients relapsed within 14 months.
So does the body become like dependent on?
I don't think they know exactly what's happening, but what the research shows is when you intervene, when you put these types of medications in somebody's body, the brain reacts in a way that now it just kind of gets trained into being depressed. So there's going to be some sort of a relapse, which is higher, clinically significantly higher than somebody who has a bout with depression, their depression goes away. Is there going to be some sort of form of a relapse? If that person was never treated, these are, you know, statistically different, statistically conclusive that taking the medications causes you to relapse more, which is scary.
Yeah. It's so hard because of, like, yeah, you want to reduce suffering and like be wise. And like, if you genuinely need this and people need that, you know, like to feel better, but you don't want to get stuck in this.
Absolutely.
Like,
And it's part of just a whole mess that we've kind of got into of number one, people don't like to do hard things anymore. This is a bigger discussion, but like when there's any sort of pain, when there's any sort of struggle, there's any sort of suffering, we don't tend to just try to deal with it, you know, the way people have dealt with it for thousands of years. It's what can I do immediately to try to get rid of this?
Yeah.
Right. And we've been so trained to think that medicine is so scientific and is the best way to do things that it's just completely normal to go and take some sort of medication to get rid of your suffering. And again, is there times where that's necessary? Absolutely. And again, thank God for those times. But I think we've just been so easily going that route, and
right.
medical community is, I mean, again, this is a business that we're dealing with, right?
Right.
Pharmaceutical companies, there's the third leading cause of medication.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's not like you said, it's not a bunch of nonprofit companies trying to just help people. They're also trying to, you know, do well in business. So this is a whole mixture of things that have led to what it is. Last thing I'll talk about with this article. So it says unmedicated depression versus medicated depression today. Prior to the widespread use of antidepressants, depressed patients regularly got well and many never suffered a second bout of major depression. Today, the overwhelming majority of patients diagnosed with major depression and treated with antidepressants suffer bouts of the illness. But what does the unmedicated depression look like today? Does it run a better long-term course than medicated depression? Researchers in Europe, Canada, and the United States have conducted a variety of naturalistic studies that help answer that question. This one is called Outcome of Anxiety and Depressive Disorder in Primary Care. In the British study of 148 depressed patients, the never medicated group saw their symptoms decrease by 62% in 6 months, whereas the drug-treated patients experienced only 33% reduction in symptoms. Another one, in a retrospective study of 10-year outcomes, Dutch investigators found that 76% of those treated with an antidepressant recovered and never relapsed, compared to only 50% of those prescribed an antidepressant. So now they're comparing people who, actual studies of saying, hey, okay, we're not going to treat these people, we're going to treat these people, and we're going to see what happens with them. And the long-term outcomes, the research is showing it's much better with people who were never treated.
Okay.
So that's a big deal.
Yeah.
A big deal because, again, if everything that we just said didn't happen, right? And I'm going to get into some of the potential side effects here, because I know we're running out of time. Like if it was just, hey, you have, let me hear your symptoms. Sounds like depression. I'm going to give you this diagnosis. I'm going to give you this medication. Let's try it, right? If there was no problems with you taking that medication, then that would be fine, right? Because mm-hmm. you're suffering, right? You're unhappy, you're sad, all those things. And that's a serious thing. That's a big deal. But to say, hey, let's just try this, when we know that long-term outcomes are worse for people who try it, and we know that increases relapses of depressive episodes if you try it. And then now listen to this list. All patients being treated with antidepressants for indication should be monitored appropriately and observed closely for clinical worsening, suicidality, and unusual changes of behavior, especially during the initial few months of a course of a drug therapy. Excuse me. Or at times of dose changes, either increases or decreases. The following symptoms: anxiety, agitation, panic attacks, insomnia, irritability, hostility, aggressiveness, impulsivity, psychomotor restlessness, hypomania, and mania have been reported in adult and pediatric patients being treated with antidepressants for major depressive disorder, as well as other indications, both psychiatric and non-psychiatric. So that's
some serious stuff.
That's some serious stuff. And that is the label. So it's the label. Every time you get a medication, you can read the label of the side effects. That was for Lexapro. Full prescribing information for Lexapro. So not only is there better long-term effects for people who are not treated, higher increases of relapses if you are treated, then so people who aren't treated they don't have the side effects of anxiety, agitation, panic attacks, insomnia, and irritability. Again, I'm not trying to discredit any sort of suffering that they're going through at the time. But we have to definitely know the truth about these medications to be able to make a proper risk versus reward.
Absolutely.
And for us, we would want to say, hey, let's try to figure out why. Right? Let's try to figure out. If it is a chemical imbalance, which they're starting to realize that it's not as simple as just saying you have low serotonin levels. But if that is the case, then let's figure out how to boost your serotonin levels. Mm-hmm. Let's actually do some blood work to see, hey, maybe this is just a thyroid problem that you have that's, you know, showing up as depressive symptoms. And if we address your thyroid problem, because if you have low thyroid, everything goes down, right? You have low energy, you can't lose weight because low metabolism. Your hair starts to fall out because it doesn't grow because your hair is not growing quickly. And obviously, mood is going to go down. So all of those things. So it might be a thyroid problem, right? It might be an adrenal problem that you have. Some sort of adrenal fatigue or HPA axis dysfunction. So there's a bunch of things of why you might be depressed.
Right.
Let's try to figure these things out. Instead of just going to medication, because there's a lot of risk to taking these things.
Totally, yeah.
So I'll just end, because I know, again, we've went really long today.
That's okay.
a couple resources. So I read from that website, which I already mentioned, but a couple big names that I would say you'd want to pay attention to if you're more interested in this topic. Dr. Peter Breggin. He is a board-certified psychiatric medical doctor. Wrote a ton on this. He's done a lot of video on this. You know, he's a psychiatrist, but he's, you know, speaks out against antidepressant medications and other forms of antipsychotic medications, ADHD, all that type of stuff.
Yeah.
So he's somebody to follow. And then Dr. Kelly Brogan, another functional medicine type doctor who is a psychiatrist. She also has a lot of good information about this topic. So some resources you can look into.
Right. Hopefully that's encouraging to people that might be in the situation, that there are, you know, people who can help you find like the genuine root causes to this and heal it, you know, from the inside out, rather than just kind of masking it and having all those risks and
absolutely
all those things to go along.
And we mentioned at the beginning that we just did this workout, and they have done a lot of studies that show that exercise is just as powerful as any sort of antidepressant and lowering medication. So another reason to come join us
just
on Saturdays.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. Yep. So see you guys next Saturday.
Yeah.
No, but if you know of anyone who could be helped by this episode, please be sure to share it with them. Leave us a rating in the podcast player that you listen to this on, and we hope that this is a blessing to you. We'll talk to you next time.